NOLA History Guy Podcast, April 2nd, 2016. Hello and welcome to NOLA History Guy. There have been over 50 streetcar lines operating at one point or another in the history of New Orleans, but only one is truly immortal, Desire. Tennessee Williams saw to that in 1947 with his Pulitzer Prize winning play, A Streetcar Named Desire, and the 1951 film based on the play. The story of Blanche, Stella, and Stanley continues to captivate those who read and see the play and watch the film, transporting them back to a time when the French Quarter in New Orleans was more of a residential neighborhood than it's been in over 40 years. The green arch-roof streetcars that ran on the Desire Line in the 1940s are both a means of transportation and a metaphor in Williams' hands. Well, since I taught high school history rather than high school literature, let's talk today about Desire as a means of transportation. I'll defer to the lovely and talented Mrs. Neuberger and the other wonderful English teachers at my alma mater, Brother Martin High School out in Gentilly, for the literary analysis. The literal streetcar named Desire is the Desire Line, established by the New Orleans Railway and Light Company in 1920. The purpose of the Desire Line was to connect residents of the French Quarter and the Upper Ninth Ward with Canal Street. Streetcars have been doing this since 1902, when the Carondelet Line was extended from exclusive uptown service, crossing Canal Street, and heading out to Desire Street. At the same time, Carondelet was extended to run all the way up to Napoleon Avenue. And that made for one long, rambling run for the motorman, that's for sure. On October 17, 1920, the Carondelet Line was split at Canal Street and the Desire Line was born. Now, before we go further, though, let's take a moment and explain directions in New Orleans. It's difficult to use the compass to reference locations in New Orleans. We really have our own system. Uptown and downtown. If you're standing on Canal Street, that's where we start. Uptown, to the left, if you're looking towards the lake, if you're looking more or less north, you're going uptown. That's if you're standing, let's say, at Canal Street and Royal, to your left is going to be St. Charles Avenue, and you'll take that green streetcar uptown, upriver. To your right is the French Quarter. That's downtown or downriver from Canal Street. Now, Canal is Main Street, New Orleans. It's 140 feet wide. It actually was meant to have a canal on it at one time, but it never materialized. Everything originates from there. All the streets, as you go further out, well, not all the streets, that's not fair to say, but a lot of streets that cross over, just move from downtown to uptown, when they hit Canal, all the streets that go uptown are referred to as South this or that. For example, South Broad Street or South Rampart Street. When you cross Canal and go downtown, well, now you're going north. And so all the streets are North Rampart, North Alexander, North Tonty, all of those kinds of names. Lakebound and Riverbound. Well, you know, we've already confused the daylights out of you with the south and the north thing, so that's why we don't bother with that, just except for the references of the street addresses. More or less going north means going towards Lake Pontchartrain. So we don't try to get to be too complicated with that. We just say you're going lakebound, you're going north, as opposed to going more or less south, which means you're heading towards the river. So you're going up to the lake or down to the river, lakebound and riverbound. Now, let's get even more complicated, or they throw in one more complication since we're talking transit. We need to talk about inbound and outbound transit lines. Inbound lines mean that the transit line is converging on Canal Street. Whether it's coming from uptown, and it's on, it's heading downtown. It's heading from, say, St. Charles Avenue up in the Garden District, heading inbound to Canal Street. Then, of course, it comes onto Carondelet Street, turns around and goes outbound, back out to Carrollton Avenue and down to Claiborne Avenue for the end of that route. So inbound heading toward Canal Street, outbound heading away from Canal Street. Since we're talking about a downtown line, we're talking about Desire. So the inbound would be heading toward Canal Street. Then we turn back around and we head downtown. We head downriver outbound. Confused yet? Don't worry about it. Come stay here a few days and you'll have it down faster than you think. In the show notes, I've got a great picture of a t-shirt from Dirty Coast. Great t-shirt, guys. That t-shirt is takes a map of New Orleans and puts it on a compass, puts a compass on top of it, actually. And then it says Lake, River, Uptown, Downtown. Explains it all in one image. Wear that t-shirt when you're walking around. You'll never get lost. It's perfect. Okay, so the route of the Desire Line then was a downtown route. It started at Canal Street and went downriver from there. In 1920, when the line was split from Carondelet, here's how it ran. You start at Royal and Canal. Turn right onto Canal, heading lakebound on the outside track of the four-track main that was on Canal Street. But the line only stayed on Canal Street for one block. It turned right immediately at Bourbon Street for the outbound run. So then we go down Bourbon from Canal through the French Quarter to Esplanade Avenue. Right on Esplanade, riverbound now to Decatur Street. When the streetcar got to Decatur, it turned left to continue outbound and went to Elysian Fields Avenue. When it got to Elysian Fields, it made a left turn heading toward the lake, lakebound, just for a block though, and then right on Charter Street, outbound, and then down Charter Street all the way out to the Ninth Ward to Desire. When the streetcar got to Desire, it made a left turn on Desire going lakebound to North Tonti Street. On Tonti, right turn, and then continues outbound to France Road, and that was the end of the outbound run. The motorman takes a break, starts the streetcar back up, turns right onto France Road, riverbound now on France, down to Royal Street. Once it gets to Royal Street, right turn on Royal, and then straight up Royal Street to Canal on the inbound run. Now, that route was changed a little bit in 1923. Starting point was the same, Royal and Canal. Turn right onto Canal for that one block of lakebound run on Canal Street, and then right again onto Bourbon, just like the original route. Down Bourbon Street from Canal, through the French Quarter, this time crossing Esplanade and going to Paget Street, which is the end of Bourbon Street. Left on Paget for one block and then right on Dauphine to continue the outbound run on Dauphine Street to Desire. When the streetcar gets to Desire, takes a left turn there, goes lakebound to Tonti, right on Tonti, outbound to France. When you get to France Road, that's the end of the outbound run again. And then the return is exactly the same as the original route, right onto France. So you're riverbound down to Royal Street. Right turn again, returning to Canal Street via Royal. That 1923 route remained in place until the line was converted to bus operation in 1948. So this is what Williams experienced and wrote about. Williams came to New Orleans on the day after Christmas in 1938, December 26th. Let's get back to the play for a minute. Before we can talk about the streets and neighborhoods serviced by Desire, let's stop in and check with Blanche. A sailor walks up to Blanche Dubois and says, "Can I help you, ma'am?" Blanche replies, "Why, they told me to take a streetcar named Desire and then transfer to one called Cemetery and ride six blocks and get off at Elysian Fields." "I apologize that I don't do a good Blanche Dubois. I toyed with the idea of getting one of my Southern Belle friends to do that little bit, but maybe in a future podcast we'll do some streetcar quotes with a proper intonation and voice there. Okay, as a metaphor, Desire going to the cemetery and finally stopping at Elysian Fields. That's fantastic. That's what Williams wanted. As directions, well, all we can hope is that the sailor straightened out Ms. Dubois so she could find, you know, Stella, her sister. Now, if Stella and Stanley lived in the French Quarter, Blanche wouldn't need to transfer to the Canal Cemeteries line at all, because she would have gone right past them one way or the other on Desire. Desire does come to Elysian Fields, though, and crosses it, both on the inbound and outbound runs. But in the history of streetcars in New Orleans, there's never been an incarnation of the canal line that ever made it to Elysian Fields. But who cares, right? Because it's the imagery. It's that's the fun of it for the play. It's the imagery, really, that matters. So back to the streetcars. The story of the Carondelet line will make for a great prequel article, possibly even a podcast at some point, but we're going to start our discussion here with the start of the Desire line in 1920. So the first streetcar named Desire pulled out of the Poland Avenue barn and made its way to Canal Street via Royal Street on October 17, 1920. Like most of the routes feeding Canal, Desire only popped up on that main street for a block, as we said, turning from Royal onto Canal and then right back onto Bourbon Street. Down Bourbon through the French Quarter. The French Quarter of the 1940s and 50s was quite different from today. It was still a tourist attraction in the way that any old neighborhood with a rich history is. People came to New Orleans. They wanted to see St. Louis Cathedral. They stopped at the Cabildo. They checked out the Presbyterian. They walked through Jackson Square and up to the riverfront. It was still very, very popular, but the focus then was less on tourism and much, much more on just making a living from day to day. The Italian grocers in the French market, the German butchers were still around. The focus is on living, making a life. World War II suspended a lot of the growth and change of the French Quarter, but when the war ended, things picked up in a huge way, with lots of people who were looking for a change from their pre-war lives. Soldiers, sailors, Marines would come home to their hometowns. They didn't really fit, so they moved to other cities to change their lives up. No doubt Williams encountered men and women who had come to New Orleans and the French Quarter specifically like this as inspiration for his characters in Desire. In terms of population, the quarter of the late 1940s was the densest place in New Orleans. Those Spanish homes of the late 18th century had been subdivided into apartments, and the folks that worked in the restaurants, bars, and nightclubs of the quarter lived in those apartments. They lived in those Spanish homes. Now, those apartments, those big houses, they weren't air-conditioned. That's why the Spanish architecture helped work. You could basically center everything around a courtyard, let the breeze blow through. So folks kept their windows open. They lounged along the galleries of the second and third floor of those homes. And then they'd gather in the courtyards just to relax and rest after a day or have a cup of coffee in the morning before going out to work. Well, alas for Tennessee, who, when he came to New Orleans in 1928, was still Tom Williams. He didn't live in a really romantic location for that first house he was in. He'd come to New Orleans hoping to get a job, to get a position with the Writers Project of the Works Projects Administration, a WPA. He took a room in the attic of a boarding house at 722 Toulouse Street. Now, the Historic New Orleans Collection, they call that the third floor of the house at 722 Toulouse. When you look at it, it's really an attic. In the show notes, I've got a segment that was done by WGNO News just this past week where they walked through the 722 Toulouse house. And you can see, yeah, Tennessee wasn't going to be very comfortable there. He needed to get out and about to enjoy New Orleans and experience it properly. The interesting thing about that house at 722 Toulouse is that that's the block that's right in between Bourbon Street and Royal Street. So Williams encountered Desire whenever he left the house. Now, when we take visitors to New Orleans through the French Quarter, it's kind of neat to watch their reactions when you just drive them through the French Quarter. They've heard so much about everything, but from a moving vehicle, the neighborhood is just... It's quite unimpressive. You know, there are some, you get some great ironwork balconies to drive past, but the majority of the quarter's view and beauty is hidden. It's behind the walls of those Spanish homes. Walk down the dark entry tunnel of one of those houses, and you're treated to the beauty of a lovely courtyard. Go to a restaurant like Sylvain on Charter Street, or go to a number of the different art galleries and shops that are in the French Quarter, and you'll see what we're talking about here. You just walk in, you go through that darkened passage, and then boom, you get that full appreciation of what the French Quarter is all about. It's easy to do now. You just have so many of these homes have been converted to shops and restaurants and that sort of thing, that it's easy to come in. You'll find that those homes and their courtyards are very welcoming. Not so much, though, in the 1940s and the 1950s. A larger percentage of those homes were just totally residential. You didn't get to see the courtyards unless you lived there, or you knew folks that did and you came over for a visit. From the streetcar, what you saw were walled homes in those first few blocks going out, or those last few blocks coming in towards Canal Street. The French Quarter just really wasn't that big a deal to the streetcar rider. It was just getting past to get to where you had to go. The homes with the walled courtyards change to Creole cottages as the streetcar heads into the lower quarter and then down to Esplanade, crossing into the Marigny. From that 1920-1923 route, the Desire line makes a right turn when it hits Esplanade and then continued outbound on Decatur by making another left turn at Decatur. In 1920, the tracks didn't cross Esplanade at Bourbon, so a right turn onto Esplanade was easier to manage. Desire initially ran through Faubourg Marigny at Decatur Street along the wharves. And that means that the line really didn't service the Marigny, because it only touched the apex of the Marigny Triangle, where it comes together at Frenchman, Elysian Fields, and Decatur Streets. Kind of pretty much bypasses Faubourg Marigny at that point. But after 1923, the tracks on Bourbon were reconstructed, so they crossed Esplanade. Now the Desire line actually became part of Faubourg Marigny. Rue Bourbon runs through that neighborhood, but only to Paget Street, so that the streetcar has to do a one-block dogleg. It turns left on Paget and then right onto Dauphine to continue the outbound run. So, canal, down Bourbon, cross Esplanade, take a left on Paget, take a right one block later onto Dauphine, and out to Desire we go. Now, that's an interesting change from a transit and service perspective from the 1920 route. The initial run along Decatur made sense. And, you know, when I started really looking at it, you start thinking about this and you say, yeah, well, you know, there's the Pontchartrain Railroad Station at Elysian Fields Avenue in Charters. That's the old Smoky Mary train that connects Mildenburg with the French Quarter, with Faubourg Marigny and the French Quarter, along Elysian Fields Avenue. It was about a 4.5-mile railroad run from the lake back down to almost the river. But the thing was, the usefulness of the Smoky Mary train in the 1920s had become quite limited, and the railroad itself was really only about a decade away from being discontinued. It was shut down in late 1930, early 1931. So perhaps the original New Orleans Railway and Light planners thought that, well, maybe going past the Pontchartrain Railroad station at Elysian Fields and Charters made sense. So just run the streetcar right there. You're tying railroad with street rail. Logical. No problem there. Made sense on paper. But then 3 years later, they start saying, the train's not a big deal anymore. Let's run on Bourbon and then run on Dauphine through Faubourg Marigny and really service the neighborhood that way. Faubourg Marigny. You know, a lot of folks say that the current incarnation of the Marigny is what the quarter was post-World War II. The Marigny is essentially the first suburb of New Orleans. It was originally the Marigny Plantation, and in the early 1800s, the early 19th century, the owner of the plantation, Bernard Mandeville de Marigny, financed his lavish lifestyle of gambling and social exploits by subdividing the plantation land, selling the lots to potential homeowners. Now, fast forward to the turn of the 20th century, 85, 90 years later, and you get a lot of immigrant families, mostly Italians and Germans, living in the Marigny. Many of the wage earners in those families worked along the river at the light industrial facilities there, like the wharves or like Columbia Brewery. And over time, Marigny residents also started taking jobs downtown, working in the shops, department stores like D.H. Holmes or Maison Blanche, down on Canal Street, and then the restaurants and bars and shops in the French Quarter. They got to those jobs on the streetcar. To get home, they'd hop on at Canal and Bourbon and make their way back to the Marigny. Now, the Spanish influence of the French Quarter. Man, don't you just love that contradiction? The Spanish influence of the French Quarter. That's a story for another podcast, but we'll get there. The Spanish homes and that architecture style essentially ends at Esplanade Avenue. That was unique to the French Quarter as such in that sense. The Marigny, on the other hand, because of the small lots, is a really charming collection of shotgun houses and Creole cottages. Now, there were no demolition or historic preservation regulations in place in the late 19th, early 20th century, so the style of homes would change as people would, you know, fix something up, tear it down, build up something again. But the overall feel of the neighborhood is still a close, tight, dense, single-family, shotgun double kind of feel to the neighborhood. There's only so much that could be done with those small lots, so you pretty much kind of get the idea, you know, with that. So now we're going through Faubourg Marigny, so we're coming now on Dauphine Street to Elysian Fields. And that's Elysian Fields Avenue now, not the Elysian Fields of Greek mythology, of course. But when we cross, we're on Dauphine, we cross Elysian Fields, the Desire Line leaves Faubourg Marigny and enters the upper Ninth Ward, or specifically now what we call Bywater. Now, for years, Bywater was just lumped together with the rest of the upper Ninth Ward. I'm going down to the Ninth Ward, darling. But as the neighborhood began to gentrify, realtors gave it a separate identity. So instead of saying the upper nine or below canal, that kind of thing, Bywater became a thing. So the Bywater neighborhood, that first part of the Ninth Ward from the end of the Marigny, from Elysian Fields out past St. Rock, becomes an extension, essentially, of Faubourg Marigny. So here you've got these immigrant families that have come and put down roots in New Orleans. They move into the Marigny. They buy those houses in that neighborhood. The sons go off to war in World War II. They come home, and of course, they don't want to live with mama anymore. They're ready to put down roots of their own and start their own families. So they move a little further out now, down into the Ninth Ward. So they're going down just a little bit further past the Marigny. There's lots there that they could build their own homes and go a little bit further out. Some of them worked back down around the Industrial Canal and everything, so it made good sense. Or just they just wanted to get a lot and build a house and start on their own. So whether they worked down by the Industrial Canal, down by the river, or back up towards the CBD, in the CBD or on Canal Street, they still, those families, those guys coming back from the war, they still got back and forth to and from the CBD the same way on the Desire Line. The Ninth Ward. We break this large political division we call the Ninth Ward into two sections, upper and lower. The Inner Harbor Navigational Canal, commonly known in New Orleans as the Industrial Canal, is the divider between upper and lower. The Desire Line finally reaches its namesake street after traversing almost the entire length of the upper Ninth Ward. The streetcar comes, continues on Dauphine to Desire Street. It hits Desire and turns left and heads lakebound now on Desire to Tonty Street, North Tonty, since we're on the downtown side of Canal Street. Then a right turn on Tonty to France Road, and that's the outbound terminus of the Desire Line. That last part of the line, through the upper ninth, through the Ninth Ward, to the Industrial Canal, it's important because of the growth of the area. The Industrial Canal was a big deal. It was the latest in the river-to-lake waterways that start with the Carondelet Canal back in 1795. The Carondelet Canal was, that's where Basin Street comes from, the old Turning Basin, or it was referred to, of course, as the Old Basin Canal. Ran was a straight canal that ran up into mid-city, tied with Bayou St. John, and that allowed ships and, or well, small ships, luggers, small schooners, tugboats, that kind of thing, to get down into the city from Lake Pontchartrain. Then, of course, there's the New Basin Canal a little further to the west. But with the opening of the Industrial Canal, ships could come into the city from the Gulf of Mexico into Lake Bourne, Lake Pontchartrain, and then get to the river by going down the Industrial Canal to the Mississippi River, or they could come up the mouth of the river and go back out, vice versa, from the to the lake via the Industrial Canal. The land along the canal immediately became prime real estate for shipbuilding, maintenance, warehouses, import-export, the coffee business. Still something like 75% of all the coffee that comes into the United States comes in and hits the Industrial Canal. All of that just was a big opportunity for jobs and businesses in that area. And men living all over the city could get to those jobs by coming in on streetcars like the Desire Line. All right, so we're at Tonty in France. The driver takes his break, and we're ready to continue now, and we'll start the inbound run for the Desire Line. So we're at Tonty in France. The streetcar then turns onto France Road going riverbound. So it's going down France Road, and it gets to Royal Street. Royal Street, make a right turn, and it's a straight run up Royal Street. Refer to that now, down Bourbon, up Royal. So we go up Royal Street, reverse the direction, through the Upper Nine, through the Bywater, through the Marigny, back through the French Quarter to Canal Street. To this day, Rue Royale is one of the main connections from those neighborhoods into the Central Business District. It's so much easier for folks who live in Gentilly or the Night Ward to make their way down to Royal, turn right, and head up to their parking spaces and lots and garages in the CBD. So these runs, out on Bourbon, Poget, Dauphine, in on Royal, they're nothing like the average streetcar rider experiences on today's routes. The main difference? No tourists. The ridership you'd find on the streetcars from the 1920s through the 1950s were commuters. They're the folks you find on the bus lines these days. They were going to work either down into the up into the CBD or down to the Industrial Canal with a whole bunch of other possibilities in between. The older kids from those families made their way to the Catholic schools, heading into town to go up to Jesuits on Barone Street, hitting St. Aloysius on Esplanade and North Rampart, along with a whole bunch of other schools. Then a select few of older boys and girls would continue uptown from Canal Street, transferring to the St. Charles line to go up to college classes at Tulane or Loyola. The streetcar was something you did to get from one point to another. It wasn't really that much of a pleasure ride at that point in time. The clack-clack of the wheels along the tracks, the whir of the electric motors, the clang of the bell as the motorman clears the path, all of these sounds were part of life along the streets of the line. Now they're limited, so basically just limited to St. Charles Avenue and Carrollton Avenue as you hear those sounds from the old green streetcars, because well, let me tell you, it's much as I love the red streetcars that run on Canal, those new propulsion systems, you don't get that clack clack and that whirr anymore. It's just not the same. But when in the golden age of streetcars in the 20s in particular, so much of those sounds were a part of every neighborhood in New Orleans. And when it came to the Ninth Ward, the Marigny, the Bywater, and the Quarter, that was the Desire Line. Now, most commuters read the newspaper, you know, had morning and evening newspapers back in those days, perhaps read a book, maybe just get lost in their own thoughts along the way. But that doesn't mean that watching the Ninth Ward go by was boring, because any trip through a living neighborhood has its fun sights and its shops and its characters and interesting things along the way. Can you actually find what you desire on a ride from the Ninth Ward through the French Quarter and to Canal Street before you get to the cemeteries? Sure, if you adopt a proper New Orleans attitude. We'll take a short break, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit about the actual streetcars that took you to your desire. This edition of NOLA History Guy is brought to you by Elysian Fields Press, publisher of Edward Branley's two novels. Dragon's Danger is a young adult story of three teens from suburban New Orleans who hatch a dragon's egg and their adventures as they help their dragon fully evolve. Hidden Talents is an urban fantasy story set in New Orleans. New Orleans is hot, humid, spiritual, and magical. Anita Della Torre is a junior executive for a publishing company specializing in Christian books and homeschooling materials. One of her responsibilities is to be her company's liaison with a New Orleans-based radio preacher whose books her company publishes. A group seeking to discredit her is all too successful, and Anita must take steps to stop them using any means at her disposal. And Anita's means are formidable. She is a sorceress whose psychic talents extend well beyond those of most mortals. Renard Alciator is a 34-year-old photographer who enjoys using his computer skills to mock Anita's client, the Reverend J. Hadley. As Ren begins to receive information of financial and sexual improprieties from inside J. Hadley Ministries, his life is threatened. In the process, his own talents are revealed. He is placed under the protection of a shadowy organization known as the Assembly as he learns to use his talents to improve his photography, help others where he can, and defend his own life when challenged. What were once hidden talents emerge in the hot New Orleans summer. Only one will walk away when the duel is joined. Okay, we're back and we're talking about the Desire streetcar line. The reality of riding Desire is just as interesting as Williams' play and then some. Now that we've explored the neighborhoods serviced by the Desire line, let's look at the streetcars that rolled along those streets. The run out to Desire was always electric service. Even the Carondelet line before that didn't cross Canal until 25 years after electrification. Everything's electric for this story. So the first electric streetcars to hit the tracks in New Orleans back in 1894, 1895 were what were called single truck cars. The term trucks refers to the set of two axles, four wheels, that are attached to the streetcar body. Smaller streetcars only needed one set of those two axles, four wheels, one truck. Larger streetcars that seat more passengers were double truck cars, where you had a set of wheels on either end of the larger body. Electric streetcars that made using public transit so much easier and faster over the mule-drawn streetcars. So naturally, when electrification took place, demand increased in a big way. And all of these streetcar operating companies, there were a number of them at the time in the late 1890s, were immediately going out all over the country to place orders and to buy these single-truck electric streetcars. In 1896, one of those companies, the Claiborne and Canal Company, took delivery on an order of single truck cars designed by an engineering firm from New York, Ford, Bacon, and Davis. And their design was picked up by the St. Louis Car Company and built out. And those FB&Ds, Ford, Bacon, and Davis streetcars, turned out to be very well suited to operation in New Orleans, and the other transit companies picked up on this and placed their own orders for Ford, Bacon, and Davis streetcars. Now, the electric streetcars are getting popular, and the number of riders grew at the turn of the 20th century, and basically the single-truck streetcars that were running on the lines at that time just couldn't keep up. So the solution was simple, just buy bigger streetcars. So the first generation of double truck streetcars were wood frame cars built by companies like Brill. Their lifespan, though, because they were all wood construction, just wasn't very economical for the transit companies. So those cars were phased out in favor of steel frame cars, like the American car company's Palace cars. Those replaced the Brills and the earlier streetcars, particularly on, well, for the Palace cars, Canal Street and Esplanade, where the Canal and Esplanade lines, they were run on those lines very, very regularly. Now, by 1915, the city's streetcar operations were consolidated into a single corporate entity known as the New Orleans Railway and Light Company. The consolidated company purchased 50 double-truck streetcars, steel construction, that were known as the design of the streetcar was known as an arch roof. It was a curving roof. Those particular double-truck streetcars were from the Southern Car Company of High Point, North Carolina. They were put into operation primarily on the uptown routes, St. Charles, Tulane, the belt service on those streets. Riders really enjoyed the arch roof streetcars to the point where the second consolidated entity, New Orleans Public Service Incorporated, affectionately known all across town and to this day as NOPSI, decided to standardize on the arch roof design in 1923. They basically took those, went back to Perley Thomas, who had formed his own company by then, and purchased a whole bunch of those arch roof streetcars. One production run there was the 800 series, and then the other production run were the 900 series. Now, what does all this have to do with Desire? Well, with the Palace cars servicing Canal and Esplanade and the arch roof cars servicing the busy uptown lines, the older single truck cars by 1920 were assigned to the back of town lines that were spreading out from Canal Street, bringing riders up through the back streets of uptown and the back streets of downtown and servicing the neighborhoods directly. Smaller ridership than the big lines like Canal and Esplanade or Tulane and St. Charles, so that the single truck cars could handle that. The streetcars then basically operating at the time, so this is, 1919 or so, on that really rambling long Carondelet line, were the Ford Bacon and Davis single truckers. In 1919, the roll board on a Ford Bacon and Davis car running on Carondelet would have said, boom, Carondelet Street. You can see a roll board, by the way, you got a picture of Earl Hampton's reconstruction of a Desire roll board sign back in the show notes. So in 1919, you had that big Carondelet, boom, and that was on the roll board there and show you what line you're on. And then, of course, there's always another roll board that'll have a destination. So it would say Carondelet with a destination sign of Desire. So in October of 1920, the line is split, and now when the streetcar comes onto the Desire line, the roll board just simply said Desire. At 1915, when the consolidation to New Orleans Railway and Light took place, there were about 33 Ford Bacon and Davis cars running on the downtown side, older cars from one of the older companies running out of the Poland Avenue barn. Those cars serviced the Desire line until 1923-1924, when NOPSI begins to phase in the 800 and 900 series arch roof cars. Now, the original arch roof cars were from the Southern Car Company, but Perley Thomas had opened up his own company by then to manufacture and sell this particular design of streetcar. And that became the Perley A. Thomas Company, also in High Point, North Carolina. And that's where we got our quote-unquote green streetcars that still run in town to this day. So the 800, 900, and later 1000 series arch roof streetcars were the last new streetcars ever purchased by NOPSI. Those cars were the only ones running on the streets of New Orleans from 1935, when the last of the Palace cars were taken out of service on Canal and Esplanade. That was it. Everything was the arch roof, or the green streetcars, if you will. and there would be no new streetcars in New Orleans until 1997, when the 400 series riverfront streetcars that were manufactured up at the Carrollton station at the workshops at Carrollton entered service on the riverfront line. And now there's one exception to that, because there's still one Ford Bacon and Davis single truck car still remains in the city. NOPSI 29, now NORTA 29, the last Ford Bacon and Davis car, still runs as a sand car, service car, mostly on St. Charles. And there's a photo of NORTA 29 in the show notes, so you'll be able to see it and appreciate the size of the car compared to the Pearly Thomas or the 900 series cars. Let's go back to Blanche. What you are talking about is desire. Just brutal desire. The name of that rattletrap streetcar that bangs through the quarter, up one old narrow street and down the other. Stella asks, haven't you ever ridden on that streetcar? Blanche replies, it brought me here, where I'm not wanted and where I am ashamed to be. Yeah, that rattletrap streetcar to which Blanche refers would be an arch roof car we now refer to as a green streetcar. That's the old NOPSI green livery as opposed to the new Riverfront and Von Dulles streetcars constructed by New Orleans Regional Transit Authority since 1997, which were all painted red. By the beginning of World War II, NOPSI was looking to discontinue as much streetcar service as possible, replacing them with rubber tire buses. World War II forced the company to put this plan on hold, though, since rubber and gasoline were rationed items, and the automobile factories that made transit buses had been repurposed to make tanks, trucks, and other vehicles for the war effort. NOPSI was stuck with streetcars for the duration. Since their intent was still to get rid of them, the company didn't put too much into the fleet in terms of upkeep and maintenance. Now, Williams lived in the quarter, right between both sides of the desire line, so no doubt he experienced those rattle traps firsthand. When treated with respect and affection, streetcars can have an operational life between 75 and 100 years. Without that respect and affection, however, riding those what were then 24-year-old streetcars that Williams experienced in the quarter, that could be a grind. And it was a grind to the commuters as well. You know, nowadays we look back on all the streetcar closures, the line closures, and we wonder, what were they thinking? Because we love streetcars. The riders were thinking, those buses, they look a lot more comfortable on my morning and evening commute. And that was even before they were air-conditioned. Now, Tennessee Williams likely didn't know about NOPSI's desire to convert desire when he published his play in 1947. The last full day of streetcar service on the Desire line was May 29, 1948, and the streetcar named Desire returned to Canal Station for the last time on May 30th of 1948, the next day. By the time the movie, based on Williams' play, was filmed in 1951, there were no tracks to run streetcars on Bourbon and Royal Streets. All the scenes had to be shot on Canal. The arch roofs still operated on the canal and streetcar lines back then. So, you know, they could manage, right? Make things work out, that sort of thing. The 800s and 900s were still in business along Canal and St. Charles, so that the production company used NOPSI 922 in the movie. So 922 truly becomes the streetcar named Desire. My friend Earl Hampton, who wrote a really, really good book on streetcars updating the original Hennick and Charlton book from 64 to the present, Earl is a big believer that NORTA 922, that green streetcar, should have a plaque marking that this was the car used in the movie. So that streetcar, it made the 35 car cut in 1964 when Canal was converted to bus service. Basically, all the other 800s and 900s were sold off to museums and other cities, were just cut in half. But 35 of those cars were still around, and NORTA 922 still runs up and down St. Charles and Carrollton Avenue, as well as in the little part of the CBD on Carondelet that has streetcar service. One of the groups that organized in 64, albeit a bit too late, to try to save streetcar operation was indeed called Streetcars Desired. To this day, most of the arch roof streetcars that were purchased and preserved by trolley museums across the country operate their Nazi cars with a Desire roll board. Moviegoers love to see Brando yell, "Stella!" in the film. Literature students study the play, commenting on Williams's writing, use of metaphor. Then there are those of us who stand on Bourbon and Canal, imagining those arch-roof streetcars making the turn, heading out to the Ninth Ward. Okay, that's our story of the streetcar named Desire. Lots of photos and comments on the website. It's NOLAHistoryGuy.com on the show page. Lots of notes, lots of photos and everything to give you a look and feel for what we've been talking about. So much fun putting this show together. Thanks to the Historic New Orleans Collection for their Frank Studios Nazi photos of the line. The bulk of the data on the routes and streetcars for the podcast comes from the book The Streetcars of New Orleans by Lewis Hennick and Harper Charlton, first published in 1964. Link, of course, on the show notes page to that book. Thanks also to Earl Hampton for continuing Hennick and Charlton's work in his book, The Streetcars of New Orleans, 1964 to present. And while we're talking about books, don't forget my book, New Orleans, The Canal Streetcar Line. It's one of my titles in Arcadia Publishing's Images of America series. Thanks again to Dirty Coast for their great geography lesson on a t-shirt. And last but not least, thanks and a big shout out to the guys and gals at Wake and Bacon, which is a breakfast place, brunch place on Banks and Alexander Streets in Mid-City. Such a great place to eat, have coffee, and for me to write and just generally think things through. Thanks again. We'll catch you next time for another edition of NOLA History Guy.